The early chapters of this series focus on a man we refer to as Abu Huzaifa al-Qanati, who claimed to be a member of ISIS and said he had committed multiple murders while in the Islamic State. In several episodes of the series, we documented his story, as well as our efforts to verify aspects of it. In September of 2020, 2.5 years after this podcast was released, the Canadian police arrested Huzaifa.
An Ontario man who claimed he had conducted executions for the so-called Islamic State is facing the rare charge of faking his involvement with a terrorist group. The 25-year-old has been identified by sources as the same man who featured in a New York Times podcast called Caliphate. In that podcast, he claimed he carried out executions for ISIS in Syria and then returned home to Canada a free man. The RCMP now say he made it up. He's been arrested and charged.
Whose real name is Shai Rose Chowdhury, and charged him with perpetrating a hoax. That charge led the Times to conduct its own investigation, which found a history of misrepresentations by Chowdhury and no corroboration that he committed the atrocities he described in the Caliphate podcast. As a result, the Times has concluded that the episodes of Caliphate that presented Chowdhury's claims did not meet our standards for accuracy. In this feed, we've published a conversation with the executive editor of the Times, Dean Baquet, where he discusses the original reporting in Caliphate and what the Times has found in its re-examination of the story.
I love your podcast and your Twitter.
No, thank you. Yeah, I remember because you've also been a patron of the show for a while. I also think.
Well, you know, I got to support the content I want to see.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you. So I'm very excited to have you on. I wish it was for a more fun topic, but maybe we can make it fun.
I think we can make it fun.
Because this is like, I want to play like the thing soundtrack, like the Benny Hill music throughout the entire thing, because this is the funniest. Like if there weren't such like sad things behind this story, like it would be hilarious, but like it's like kind of tragicomical. And you know this whole thing very well. We're here to talk about Caliphate, the very bad podcast from the New York Times from 2018. First of all, I didn't even get you to introduce yourself. Can you please introduce yourself? And then we'll go back.
Yes, my name is Umbereen Dadaboy. I have a PhD in English literature. I study race and religion and early modern drama. I also, I guess, have a side interest in Islamophobia and war on terror culture in the early modern period and also in our moment as we live through the war on terror and its many offshoots in pop culture, media, and U.S. policy.
So naturally, this took you to the Caliphate podcast, and you very brave, in a very brave and heroic manner, you waded through this garbage podcast and listened to it, and you did a good, very interesting sort of read through, and that's what we're here about to talk about today. At this point, I will have edited in a little bit of the clip, but essentially, they recently, to bring people up to speed, or maybe you should just do it. You know it better than what is Caliphate, what happened, and yeah.
Sure. Caliphate is a New York Times podcast that is about the Islamic State, and it is also about insider knowledge on the Islamic State that the reporter Rukmini Kalimachi gets through finding a former ISIS member who was there, who purportedly was there when ISIS took over Mosul and founded their promised state. Turns out, though, and so this podcast came out in 2018. There were a lot of Muslims, obviously, who objected to the kind of orientalizing and pathologizing of Muslims that this podcast was engaged in. But of course, nobody cares what Muslims think about people representing them. So it went ahead, won a lot of awards, got a lot of critical accolades, Turns out, though, that her informant, Shairoz Chaudhry, was under surveillance by the Canadian authorities for trying to perpetrate a terrorist hoax. And so they finally charged him, I think, in September of 2020. And that's when things started to unravel for the podcast. But if you listen to it, episode 6, I think, shows us when things are beginning to unravel because the timeline doesn't make sense. But because they need it to make sense, they kind of make it work. So I didn't listen to the podcast in 2018 because I had my fill of this kind of entertainment. But I did listen to it after all of this came out because I just wanted to know how you get to this point where you kind of ignore things that don't make sense because you're really serving the story that you want to tell.
So this story, right, is about how stories are written about the Orient, about Islam, about violence, about terrorism. I mean, that's what's interesting here. I mean, at the outset, I'll say that, like, I've consumed a lot of ISIS media personally because of the fact that, like, I follow the Syria war, I follow Iraq stuff, like, I've been following it for years now. And by follow, I mean, I follow a lot of, like, basically freak accounts that like normal people in like our professional world would like never follow in a million years. But I followed them because I just have been living on Twitter and sort of reading the news for a long time, which is not to say it's some accomplishment on my end, but it's that more to say that I have a kind of very liberal follow-up policy. And because of that, I see things and I encounter things that are beyond the pale. Like, I have seen countless ISIS execution videos, just people straight up murdering, images I will never burn out of my head. And this is very common for anybody who follows our regions. It's not, I feel like this is also true with South Asian media too, right? Like, they don't hide the limbs the way that our media does, right? They don't sanitize it. Like, this is the funny sort of gaslighting that occurs around Western media, but that the idea that somehow our corporate owned media somehow does some authentic job of representing the world, even though, like, statistically fewer and fewer minutes of most news broadcasts are taken up with foreign policy and most of it is so-called embedded journalism. So, like, it's not like they don't have much of a leg to stand on when they claim to be kind of these institutions and whatever of knowledge. And so, like, the fact that this caliphate thing exists, and I never listened to it. I listened to it the first time today, and I messaged you, and I cannot believe how dumb this thing is. Like, I can, it's actually like, it's, and this is actually an insult to undergrads, but it's like sophomoric undergraduate, like, but highly well produced. And like, and you listen to it, and I listened to the first 3 episodes because that's what you told me to do. And I was like, I can't do any more of this. And it insults anyone's intelligence that this person who never mentions anything about Arabic, who makes all kinds of absurd claims about this whole world being sealed off, like, we can get out to that. Like the fact that this is like an expert. So anyways, I'm ranting and I've started the episode, basically. Sorry, I just had this big bulge of thoughts that I was like, okay, I can't believe this happened. And she, I mean, what's crazy is that she won these awards, like Peabody, whatever, like all these like liberal institutions falling over themselves to reward this person for, even if it was true, it wasn't that interesting. You know what I mean? Like, even if we didn't have this reason to talk about it right now, it wasn't that interesting. It was like an 8-part podcast. So, like, I have kind of like podcast producer feelings about this. And then I also have like Orientalism scholar feelings about this, because both of these are fused together, and how like the cliches of podcast production are really all here from, you know, the sort of intros and stuff. Anyways, how about, okay, blah, blah, blah. That was a big, big jumble of a question. I'm getting carried away. Okay, how about this? So can you take us through the narrative of it? Because the reportage is half the story, right? Like, I find it such a tell that the logo of the podcast is half her face and half something else. Because it's half about this reporter, Rukmini Kalamanchi.
Chapter 1, The Reporter. Hello.
Yeah, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
So, Rukmini,
mm-hmm.
before I started following you around all the time,
yes.
I knew that you were a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that you talked to terrorists on the internet.
Right.
I knew that ISIS was your beat. But I don't think I had any idea what that reporting actually looks like.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Hey, Hawk. When you hear that, it's outgoing? Outgoing.
Like, I didn't know you are going right up to the front lines of the war against ISIS.
There's a building that appears to have been airstriked.
And as the coalition soldiers are pushing ISIS back...
Can you ask him, have these buildings been cleared?
You are right there, directly behind them.
What are you doing right now?
I'm trying to get out some trash bags. We're about to go into the building.
And you pull out garbage bags.
Hang on, stick it here.
Like trash bags that you've brought from home.
Right.
And you just start picking stuff up.
A bunch of computers, hard drives yanked out.
Like garbage out of buildings.
This is a school booklet.
So we basically have an ISIS tent right here. So we're in the right place.
And when I tell people about that part of your job,
mm-hmm.
they almost always ask two questions. First,
there's a backpack right there and I really want to search it, but I'm a little scared to put my hand inside it.
Isn't that dangerous?
They could be booby-trapped, huh?
Could be.
And I'm always like, yes, like, very dangerous.
Fuck.
There are explosions.
That's close.
And gunfire.
Hey, smoke. You see this?
And airstrikes.
How many airstrikes have you heard before?
Three or four?
Try like 10.
And the other question they ask is, how is that worth it?
Right.
Like, what do you say to that?
Yeah. I mean, so when I saw that, I was also surprised by the kind of branding. Right. Like the cover of the podcast. We don't have CD covers anymore, but right. Her, half of her face, as you said, the other half of it is sort of a bombed out sepia colored Middle Eastern geography. Right. And there was this great tweet about how here's some war porn orientalism that's selling this podcast. And that's exactly right. Right. She doesn't have to be specific. Like we can intuit that this from the title of the podcast, Caliphate, that this is some Iraqi city or some city in the Middle East, but we're also intuitive, like we're also seeing her face there. And so she's our guide, but she's also, it's also this white woman. So there's a very interesting moment of white imperial feminism that is going on that for me really recalled Laura Bush and the way that she framed the Afghanistan war as really freeing Afghani women and then also freeing women all over the world, because really what the Taliban wanted was to take over the whole world. And here then we have ISIS, who is founding some so-called dream of an Islamic state that apparently all Muslims have, except we didn't get the memo. And here she is going to lead us through this story. And the story really hinges on her journalistic expertise and experience in covering terrorist hotspots. So that's what she brings, except that she doesn't know the language of the places that she's covering. And so it's really dubious that she has to rely so much on her translator, which is not to say her translator is translating things incorrectly. I don't want to cast aspersions on him, but he certainly knows who and what he's working for, right? Who and what he's feeding. It's not as though people who work on the ground in these places don't understand what the Western appetite is for these kinds of stories. So there's that. And then she finds this guy on Instagram who, was in ISIS, self-proclaimed, and she kind of believes him based on the things he tells her. But the things he tells her are things that she's kind of already reported. And as you said, if anybody would take a deep dive into all things ISIS or all things that were happening in Syria and Iraq at that point, it's pretty easy to rehearse the facts that somebody wants to hear so that you can present yourself as an authentic witness to this place. And so that's what ends up happening. Her informant takes her through and tells her all of the things that she already knows in a lot of detail about how ISIS was structured, what they asked people to do, the kinds of murders that they required of him. And so his story is the story that gives the podcast the kind of intimacy that I think is lacking in what a journalistic account would be.
Right. And so the journalistic account of this, though, is inscribed into the story, right? So like the first episode, I mean, this is what was really interesting to me. There's so much filler to this podcast. It's like I can sort of smell it from a mile away as somebody who's produced content. And sometimes there is sometimes filler, like, and I can tell. So like that whole first, I'm going to clip in these things because it starts with this thing about, well, if you come into my house, it's all about her.
Imagine if you walked into my home right now, right? If you walked in right now, you would probably find my Bank of America statement. If you found that, you would find all of my daily transactions. You would know what diet I have. You would know that I have a penchant for buying a certain kind of rice milk. You would know the stores that I go to shop at. So you might conclude from that I'm probably middle class. If you walked over to the bookshelf, you would find books in Romanian, in English, and in French. And you could deduce from that I most likely speak three languages or that members of my family are bilingual or trilingual. If you went upstairs and you went into my bedroom and you found my diary, you would find my most private thoughts.
And you're saying you do that.
And so I do that. So I am doing that to ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
Right? I am looking for ISIS's diary.
So she's explaining the basic concept of literacy and what diary means. So this is filler, right? This is obviously filler of someone who's like very much in tune with how this story sounds and how it's built around her. And I was baffled by this. I was like, how did this get into a New York Times podcast? Did they really not have an extra 5 minutes that they had to put this in? Because this is irrelevant. Nobody cares. Get to the point. Like, but then you realize the fascination with her, with this woman, her face, her daringness to go into these places. And then you're like, oh shit. If you follow the story, it's written like a pilgrimage. It's written like a pilgrimage, like an Oriental traveler account, except the travel is to this fucking doofus in Toronto. like it's like this, and it's traveling to him and saying to him, like, and like all this sort of, and performing for him. And you can tell that they started the podcast and they didn't plan, like they were like, oh, this is great. Like they didn't account for the fact that this could go wrong. And by episode 6, they're like, shit. Like, and instead of just doing the normal person thing to do, which is pull out the piece of paper from the typewriter, crinkle it up and throw it away, they kept it. They kept it. Like, these people care so little about their own integrity because it doesn't matter functionally. Like, it doesn't even matter what they say. Right. So the fact that they were wrong, it was like, fuck it, we'll fix it in post. We'll make it stitch together somehow. And it was like, I mean, that's just, again, I'm ranting here. I have so many thoughts. It's all just.
No, I agree. And the fact that there have been no, like, really, like, she's been reassigned. She's not going to cover terrorism anymore. But there really hasn't been any accountability. We haven't heard anything about what's happened to the producer. We've just seen kind of the New York Times circle the wagons, and their last episode where they kind of go through and sort of see where the mistakes were made in the vetting process, even that is not about the journalist, which it should have been given the primacy that she has in not just being the vehicle for telling the story, but actually being in the story, which is what you're pointing out, right? She is protected. And that too, I think, is, again, it brings us to this kind of the vulnerability of white women within this kind of milieu, right? Like, Orientalist tales are full of that. And here, and in that episode, the reporter, she talks about ISIS kind of hunting her down.
Yeah, as if they care, as if that's their issue, to go after this clown.
You had me turn off the microphone.
I had to turn off the recorder, right?
Right. And then you told me a story, and I think that Would you tell that story now?
About the 911 call?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So, I don't usually scare easily, but in 2015, I get a phone call from the FBI. Are you Mr. Rukmini Kalimaki? Yes, I am. May I come to see you right now? I can be at your office in the next 20 minutes. And we went into a conference room not far from here, and the agent read a prepared statement. He said, you are the subject of a targeted threat from the Islamic State, and we can't tell you more. That was the first serious threat. But it started to percolate, you know, somewhere, that they were noticing what I was doing. Since then, I've seen how I've become a presence in their online chat rooms. They talk about my reporting. They dissect my tweets. They sometimes insult me. And these insults, if I can just say so, sometimes are pretty funny. I think they figured out that I'm sensitive about my weight. So they sometimes call me Oink Meanie instead of Rukmini. It's Oink Meanie, like pig. Fat Machi. Oink Meanie, Fat Machi. I'm sorry to laugh. I'm laughing because I mean, there's something ironic about being fat shamed by ISIS, you know? So, you know, they'll make jabs about how I've put on a couple of pounds based on my latest, you know, TV appearance. But then sometimes what they say is dead serious. So, for example, when I was in Mosul a couple of months ago, they started talking about how they were hoping that I would get killed in Mosul, just like the Kurdish journalist who was killed there at the same time in the city.
Hmm.
But then, let's see, what are the others?
Do you have like a folder on your phone where you keep the threats? Is that what I'm looking at here?
Yeah, exactly. One of them is a masked man who was holding up a knife that he's pointing towards the camera. And he said, under a picture of me, wanted to be kill this crusader woman that refuses to join to Islam, Rukmini Kalimaki. Please join to religion before beheading or truck from our soldiers of Islamic State. Okay, pretty explicit. So they created a channel where they're pretending to be me. And then they're pretending to post in this channel as me. And it says, I have to confess something here. I started covering ISIS because they are real men. I always fantasize about getting raped by them. That's all my fantasies. This is the sole reason I made multiple trips to Mosul just to get captured by ISIS so that they can fulfill my desires. So I'm used to this stuff now, but back when the FBI first came, it didn't really sink in. It was so unbelievable that honestly, I think I just stored it away somewhere else. And then weeks went by.
There was another apparent terror attack in Europe, this time in Germany.
And months went by.
A series of deadly bombs, at least one packed with nails, killing dozens, injuring hundreds.
And in that period of time, I covered attack after attack.
Two terrorists stormed the church during morning mass, taking a priest, two nuns, and two churchgoers hostage.
And
a planned and deliberate attack in suburban Sydney.
It starts to just marinate in your consciousness.
Yeah.
German media reports the attacker shouted Allahu Akbar as he hacked at the passengers.
And then about a year later, I was home alone late at night. So I'm home alone. And I'm by myself because at this point in time, my husband was working the overnight at his company. At 12:30, I think, at night, I'm getting ready to go to bed. I'm actually under the covers, and I'm upstairs with my two dogs. And suddenly, my Rhodesian Ridgeback, which is a big dog, starts growling. The hair on his back is straight up. Immediately afterwards, I start hearing somebody ringing the doorbell downstairs. And they're ringing continuously. So it's not like knock, knock, and then go away. It's like, bzz, bzz, you know, knock, knock, knock. I'm thinking to myself, what is this? You know, like you know, who is this? What is this? So I get a hold of my husband, who assures me that it's not him. At this point, I've turned off the lights in the second floor bedroom because I don't want the people who are outside to see where I am. So the dog is barking, the knocking is going on, and the doorbell is ringing and ringing and ringing. At this point, I'm so scared that, like, my hands are not even working.
911, where is your emergency?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry to bother you. I don't know if this is an emergency. So the FBI agent who had come to see me had told me that they had alerted the particular police precinct where I lived. He said, if you ever have, you know, any issues, all you have to do is call 911. They have you on a list. We'd rather that you call rather than waiting for, you know, for something to happen.
My name is Rukmini Kalimaki, and I've had direct threats against me and my family.
Ma'am, where is your emergency?
But yes. The operator who picked up must have thought I was crazy.
Okay, so you're being... The FBI is making threats against you, is what you're saying?
No, I...
Did you see anyone?
I was afraid to go up. I was afraid to show myself. Like, I just saw the silhouette of a person.
And I can't remember exactly what the woman said, but it was something like, ma'am, are you trying to tell me that ISIS is ringing your doorbell?
Okay, I'll send an officer over to talk to you.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
Bye-bye.
So she calls me back and she says, ma'am, I'm calling to tell you that we've investigated, and it happens to be the water department. There's been a water main break on your street, and as a result of this, they're going house to house to tell the neighborhood that your toilet is not going to flush.
What do you think the moral of that story is, though?
What's the moral of that story?
Like, why is it that that's the story you chose to tell me when I asked you if you've ever been afraid?
I guess the story illustrates how I got ensnared into the very thing that ISIS is trying to do. Because in the end, the purpose of these acts of savagery and violence are to terrorize us. Mm. They're trying to scare us, right? They're trying to make themselves into boogeymen and live in our imagination. And that night...
Yeah, they got you.
They got me that night. Yeah.
But, you know, I read that moment where she's describing, like, what her house is like a little bit differently. I get your point. Obviously, it's filler, and she is kind of teaching them literacy. But it's also connected to, I don't know if you remember the San Bernardino shootings.
Yeah.
And the way that the media covered that, when they went into the home of the shooters, right, they found like a prayer rug, and they found prayer beads, and they found the Quran, and they found like a tapestry that had Allah on it. And all of these things became evidence of their fanaticism.
Around the apartment, there are signs of life familiar to families everywhere. Clutter in the kitchen, toys belonging to the couple's six-month-old daughter are scattered on the floor. But it's here in the couple's bedroom closet where you find a sign of the intense investigation that took place, as CNN's Stephanie Elam discovered during a tour of the home.
Here you can see where they smashed up into the ceiling to take a look to see what was up there. It does appear, based on how much of debris is on the ground, that there was an effort to get up there and make sure that they checked every crevice of this back bedroom.
Personal identification and other documents belonging to Farouk's mother were left scattered on the bed. Evidence of the couple's devout faith are also seen throughout the apartment. A prayer rug on the wall, various books on the subject of Islam, even prayer beads left on the edge of the bed. And here, in a corner, the crib belonging to their baby girl, left with her grandmother on the day of the shooting, a haunting reminder of what the young family might have become.
And I'm like, you could come into my house and suddenly I'll be transformed into a radical terrorist because I have a prayer rug. I have the Quran. I have, you know, a thing on my wall that says Allah, right? All of these things, like a quiet, like she's framing for us a gaze that will teach us how to interpret all of these things so that when she gets to Iraq and she finds these papers with the ISIS stamp, like, oh, suddenly this thing is sinister. And it has a lot more meaning than it might have had before. And I'm not apologizing for ISIS here or saying ISIS were not evil and sinister. That's not my point.
No, I don't. No, of course not. Obviously, we know that. But what's interesting here is that, first of all, I mean, okay, so one of the first things you'll notice if you listen to the first three episodes, you'd never know the fact that ISIS wasn't based in the West. Do you know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't know that. And if you were like an alien, you'd just listen to this thing. You'd think that ISIS was attacking New York every day, because the victims of this story are like the victims of this story are parts of the world we despise, right? It's just the Orientalist, you know, like, oh, they're tearing each other up. And so part of the ISIS sort of fascination is it's a confirmation bias thing of, oh, look, I knew they were animals. Look at the stories they tell of being animals to each other. So that even if it was true, like even if the story, this guy and his, like, it obviously made up stories, like you can just hear it in his voice. I mean, I'm now being like anti-rational, but you know this guy's like a bullshitter. You can tell, like, this is not these are games that they're feeding to us. And at least in one sense, I knew it was bullshit because I could hear the music doing so much of the work. Like, if you listen to some of those scenes, like you listen to some of the sort of dramatic points of his confessionals, which I kind of, I went and listened to a few of them because I listened to the highlights of them on newsreels. And I was like, oh shit, I better go listen to this stuff because I only made it to the first three. But you listen to it and like the sort of dramatic editing and like the flair, and they're like, oh, this is just like what they do in the Borat movies too.
You were back and forth to Pakistan, right? Did that give you a sense that you weren't like fully Canadian?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did feel different. I'd be more of the little troublemaker class clown type of kid. Like throwing snowballs or, you know, other things in class. I wasn't like messed up or anything, but like there's always that one kid that's always roasted on. I was that kid.
Like, it's just this very obvious sleight of hand that in a way kind of like embellishes and sort of grabs onto the legacy of Orientalism that's like encoded into our brains, that we were prepared to like listen to this episode because we've been listening to stories of Islamic radicalism for decades now, of like head chopping psychos and stuff like that. So like this thing of Rukmini Kalamanchi's voyage in to this horrible place. But what's funny is that like her lack of obvious competency is never questioned, right? This person does not speak Arabic. Imagine you're like a foreign reporter sent to America. You don't speak English. That would be considered like vast incompetence, but this is very normal in the American media world, the Western media world, that they have these fixers, and it ultimately doesn't matter what to speak the language of the place you're visiting because Orientalism. So like the whole thing with Rukmini is that she has this desire to be at the center of the story, which is common, right? Tom Friedman, we know that, right? Like, remember Tom Friedman when he had the Saudi peace proposal? That was the Tom Friedman Saudi peace proposal. It was all about him, right? But like, this person took that to a new level, which is the gonzo journalist into the heart of darkness. And that's like a kind of almost Victorian throwback too, right? Like, I sensed a lot of like as I mentioned before, yeah, like Orientalist travelogues, like sometimes the music and stuff like that. And then the sort of the weird contrivance of the whole thing, which was, this is an interview between the producer of the podcast and the reporter. So like the reporter is being interviewed about her story, and that was turned into a podcast. You know what I mean? Like, that was the sort of podcaster brain in this. I was like, wait a minute, what? This is how you handled it? You didn't do like the normal thing to do, which would be to turn the reportage into some kind of audio documentary. But that would take more work. That would take a little bit of investigation. That would take a little bit of, but no, they did the traditional thing of podcasters and they mixed it with the Orientalist voyage in. But the one thing that can't go wrong in those things is that you can have, like, it has all the sort of, all the fictions have to be real, so to speak, right? Like, the characters need to be firm. Here's my question for you. So after the guy was interviewed and after the podcast was released, the guy obviously got cold feet because he started retracting it too, right? Like, right, more so than what he did before. So while they're making the podcast, they notice discrepancies, and then afterwards, those discrepancies grow greater. Is that correct?
That's what seems to have happened. So as the podcast is unfolding, you have him sort of have this first meeting where he gives all of this information, and then there's a request for a follow-up meeting, but he's being cagey because the Canadian version of the FBI have called him because they want to question him or something, right? So he's on alert. This at first I thought was fake, but it seems to be real. And they must have made contact because he's sort of perpetrating this hoax now at a larger scale, being interviewed by a New York Times reporter. And that for them doesn't seem to raise any flags because, of course, the FBI or the Canadian version of it, CII, CSI, something, they think that they want him because he's a fugitive or he has managed to escape being caught by the authorities. But there are so many holes in the story in terms of his timeline that they have to make work, but also how easy it is for, is it for people who have gone and disappeared in the Middle East or in Pakistan even to then come back to the US and not be on someone's radar. My sister is a filmmaker who worked a lot in Pakistan. And because of that, and because she worked in certain northern regions, she got put on not a no-fly list, but certainly a watch list, right? And so anytime she was flying anywhere, she would have like the four S's on her boarding card, which meant that she would have extra security. So it's just really kind of this magical wishful thinking that happens in this podcast where they manage to find someone who has escaped authorities and who wants to tell, right? Who wants to confess to all of these murders too. Because if I was a murderer and I didn't want to get caught by the police, talking to a reporter might be the last thing I want to do.
That's what's so nuts about this. He's obviously lying. He's obviously lying. The cops, they wouldn't know. He would be an asset or he would be in jail. Like there's those, and if he was an asset, he would have been handled properly. He wouldn't have just shown up. Like you know what it reminds me of? Remember Close Up? You know the Iranian movie Close Up, which is like about a guy who pretends to be the director, Mohsen Makhmalbaf, the director of the cyclist, right? Like he pretends to be him and there becomes this whole drama and it gets like escalates. And then Kiarostami does this movie Close Up, kind of recreating the events. And I feel like, oh my God, this guy got caught lying because, you know, for whatever reason, he wanted to invent this story. For whatever reason, like something appealed to him that Rukmini just makes it a habit to write people, to DM people. She's just like a prominent DM slider. Like she just slides into your DMs. It's like, have you been here? Is that where you are? Can you tell me where you are? Do you want to speak? So it's like, it's all of the things. It's racist and Orientalism. It's, oh, look how savage they are. It's our news institutions that are incompetent and don't care about destroying their own brand, like inexplicably, like they don't, like all the news that's fit to print, like they don't care about their phrases anymore. But it's also just the digitalization of knowledge and like the internetification of reporting, right? Where it's DM messages, it's WhatsApp messages, it's all sort of telephony. And this is not to be like a kind of traditionalist, but it's the opposite of the kind of Robert Fisk on the ground, running across the kind of romantic image we have of the news reporter. But this Calamanchi woman, she wants both. Like if you watch her like ISIS stuff, it's again about her. There is a pathological narcissism to her whole career. And for whatever reason, the New York Times liked it and they sponsored this person, but they didn't supervise her enough. And obviously the producer fucked up and inexplicably they didn't throw away the whole thing. They were lazy, I think. And like it came back to bite them in the ass. I mean, that's my kind of general reading about this is like all of the sort of forces of our digital media era combined with Orientalism and all those things kind of gave us this tragic comical story. I know somebody actually who taught him at York. At York University in Toronto, and this person said that the guy was totally unremarkable, had nothing interesting to say, had nothing interesting to contribute to the class. These are the people that end up representing our part of the world. I mean, and that's the crazy thing, that this guy gets to speak for us.
And yes, he does get to speak for us, and not very eloquently, and he just seems like such a, you know, 22-year-old boy who...
Boss clown type of kid.
Doesn't really know what he's doing with his life and like, look at this thing. It's kind of interesting. Like even the way he talks about Islam, which the reporters kind of take as though he is giving theological pronouncements, right? Like I'm not going to go to my neighbors and be like, can you tell me about Christianity? And I'll be like, yes, this is the word of what Christians think Christianity is. But for Muslims, we like are always asked to kind of make pronouncements about our religion. And then these pronouncements are seen to have some kind of theological value. And they don't. It's just what you're raised in. And guess what? There's lots of versions of Islam. There's not just one. And this dude doesn't know that much about anything. Like I don't think you got to the conversation where she and the producer are baiting him about us versus them. And so like infidel versus... Yeah. And I've never heard the word infidel used so many times. And I just wanted to point out, I just wanted somebody to point out to her that it's like medieval Christians who called Muslims infidels first, right? Like that's not something that we go around saying to people. But again, it's just sort of all of these tropes that people want to hear. Like whenever Arabic is presented in the podcast, it's always like menacing and it's, you know, scary language. And of course, like we should fear anyone who is speaking it because it's all the villainous characters who speak Arabic. And it gets translated by her, right? It's not even some guy who is translating whatever the cleric is saying. It's always her who's translating, suggesting that she knows what it is that she's saying, except we come to find out that of course she doesn't know what she's saying.
Which is actually common among terrorism people. The whole industry of terrorism experts is filled with these kind of grifters. And she, I think the funny story here is the grifter got grifted. Some like, I mean, there's also a dimension of this, like the South Asian dimension to this. This dude is just a clueless chud. He does not have anything interesting to say. But because of like just the spotlights and everything, like he has to invent all this bullshit. But there is the undergirding thing of all this is that he's a brown Muslim and that's all that matters. But Syria is like there were more than enough people that they could have gone to get this story, right? And not just South Asians, Arabs, there were tons of people. But because this person does not, because the reporter doesn't speak Arabic and refuses to engage, she uses the word sealed off at one point. Like, oh, it's sealed off. It's sealed off from you, dumbass, because you don't know anything. it's amazing. They like the New York Times really can't just hire this person, like someone competent to then do her job for her behind the scenes and pay that person. Like, isn't that the logical thing you would do? Like, but it's like, they don't care. They don't care how they look. They lied about Iraqi WMDs. They did not report the deaths. The New York Times has been key, absolutely key to the entire edifice of news media in the world's largest empire for countless decades. And we're supposed to believe this story, right? Like when it came out, we're supposed to believe it. I know there were a bunch of people who did question at the time and a lot of voices did. And of course that never got picked up. And it was the opposite, right? It was just a flurry of attention for this reporter and it was all interesting and everybody listened to it. And it's like, you realize how small the pool is for the New York Times and not how like of terms of like who they really see as their audience and the kind of people that are important to them, that to them, it doesn't matter that this person doesn't have any Arabic. To like the, you know, 50,000 or so people who live like DC, New York, LA, San Francisco, whatever, and they can read each other's op-eds and stuff like that. The kind of people who tweet back to each other every morning and they're like, oh, I'm a, you know, it's like a small world, but it's also a very dumb and incompetent world of people who don't know what they're talking about. So stuff like this goes through the cracks and it makes them all look bad. So case in point, that one of the people, this Canadian guy, he's not Canadian. And that's part of the story here. I don't know his name. Actually, I don't know his name. Doesn't matter. Who cares? I'll link to it. But basically one of the guys, he's Tamil and he's a professor at Queen's University. You could find his name easily enough. And he has been in conversation with this guy for years, apparently. And this guy, this professor, has been invited to speak various places as an expert on this whole case. Like, this is like criminal like malpractice if you're like an intellectual, if you're a scholar, like you're an expert and you're like you're chummy with this guy who like is your also like the object of study. Like I find the whole thing like, how is this guy like, how is this guy respected enough to allow to be do this, this professor? Like it's just such an orientalist fest, this whole thing. I mean, I've been ignoring it, so that's why I'm so shocked. Like I just caught up today and I was like, holy shit, this whole thing has happened, because I didn't care at the time. Like I was ISIS'd out at that time. Like I once did like I was gonna do like an this is very perverse, but I was gonna do like an ISIS greatest hits album, which is to and like kind of make it ironically obviously greatest hits is that like the crazy insane violence they were guilty of, and like the things that like did not get mentioned in our media. Of course they mentioned the Paris attacks and the whatever attacks because that's what our media does, but they didn't mention the fact that like in one day in Syria 1600 people in a Shia village died, just perished off the face of the earth, and like that's not reported. Like it's only like these Rukmini idiots and the idiots at New York Times, they're ambulance chasers, but they only see one kind of violence. The rest of it just blurs in the background.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, you know, Judith Butler writes about disposable lives and frames of war, quite importantly, I think. But I mean, obviously, we can't expect people like Rukmini or anyone at the New York Times to have read and thought about why we keep coming back to the Paris attacks and not, you know, the 20-ton bomb that the U.S. dropped on Afghanistan, right? Not as you're pointing out, all of the violence that ISIS visited upon Muslim people in Syria, in Iraq, in all of these places, because that's not a story, right? There's no white peril there. I think we have to think about how Orientalism is working hand in hand with forms of white supremacy, which also then allow for this guy, Chaudhry, to, you know, be a child of Pakistani immigrants, a Canadian child of Pakistani immigrants who can so easily join ISIS. Like, does he speak Arabic? Like, we don't learn Arabic, you know, in our immigrant households. We're lucky if we learn our own language. So how is he getting to Iraq, navigating language, all of these different linguistic traditions, to be able to even attain the position that he gets? Like all of that is sort of flattened out. All of our languages, all of our distinct cultures, they don't mean anything because we're united as this kind of mass of Oriental brown people.
It's just like this perfect congealing of all of these, you know, everything they think about us already. And that's how I listened to this. That's how I listened to this episode, to this like podcast. I was like, oh, this is just this stuff. You love ISIS, actually. You love this stuff because it convinces you of what you already knew. And it gives you an excuse, and it gives your American military planners an excuse to attack these countries over and over again and keep them weak. Like ISIS is the gift that keeps on giving to the media.
Yeah. You know, that story in that first episode where she like thinks ISIS is at her door. I mean, there's so much to do with just the erotics of her relation to ISIS and her, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that she wants to be attacked by them or raped or mutilated by them, but certainly there is a kind of libidinal charge to this work. And we see it in later episodes where she's sort of so giddy at finding the treasure trove and the materials that she illegally takes out of Iraq. Like she wants to be there when the city falls so that she can comb through it before the authorities can like hide anything. And she and the New York Times have hidden things from the Iraqi authorities and have said that they will make them public so that this information can be shared with the rest of the world. But for some people, this is like personal identifying material that will actually endanger them. But of course, that doesn't matter to them because, again, the lives of these indistinct brown people don't really mean anything in the quest for our knowledge about ISIS.
Yeah. And they, oh God, so much to say. I'm so mad. I hate this fucking shit. I hate that we have to talk about this stuff that like, you know, what? Because what's insulting here, too, is that like I've seen so many interviews with like former Daesh. She's people like Syrian TV, for instance. I've seen a bunch of things from Syrian state TV of people confronting people sort of, or interviews with people who fought in Daesh, sort of admitting to how what they did, or people confronting their former captors, like harrowing stuff. But it was the people who were involved. Like, they were actual people who were involved. It was their victims. It was the actors themselves. They're not characters in some stupid drama, which is half about the reporter. like it's so insane.
I mean, what you bring up is so important, because in maybe it's episode 8 or 9, she talks about how she gets justice for this Yazidi rape victim.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
No, she does.
Oh yeah, she does. Not. She does. And she's
what
like
a shameless person.
Oh yeah. And she's like, no, these people do not have any, like nobody is getting justice for them. They're not able to confront their attackers and really put, and she actually says, if it weren't for us and the New York Times, these people would not be able to have any kind of accountability.
Fuck hell, the hubris, the fucking imperial hubris of these absolute asswipes. Just, I am throwing my microphone against the wall. Just, I have so much rage.
Yeah, don't listen to those episodes.
Oh my God. It's just, it's so naked. The kind of, just, I said ambulance chasers before, but that implies like an on the groundness. This is all done from their, like their oversized New York apartments. That's what makes it so gross. Like the same way that like the drone war is waged from like, from Tampa, you know, that like, the lives of people who are born in our part of the world, like Pakistani youth, like Pakistani men, women, children have been murdered by just illiterate chuds in Florida. And that just makes your blood boil. And this too, this is part of that war, because this has its own purpose. This promulgates a certain image. This is marshaled at a certain time that certain stories are then filtered upwards to the mass media, right? So New York Times, sure, it has a mass media audience, but it's not for the chuds. The chuds need a more watered down version. So that what the chuds got were the ISIS execution videos, right? Or were like the stories of, oh, this journalist was caught, she was raped by a gang of people and then murdered, right? Like, that lurid oriental thing is always there, just pulsating beneath the surface. Oh my God, not a beneath the surface at all. But it's, again, I just keep saying this over and over again. It tells them everything they already knew about us, and it's entertaining, right? It's not a boring monograph that nobody cares about. It's not like a Human Rights Watch report that, again, nobody cares about. Like, this is entertainment. This is something that you consume on the subway going to work, right? Like, this is something you jog
and
to.
It feeds, like, yeah, and it feeds U.S. militarism, right? Like, oh, this, it makes sense why we're there. Like, we need to go and kill these people. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, I don't know if you listened to the second season of Serial, which was about Bo Bergdahl, and they talk about in that podcast, they talk about how he wants to join the military so that he can go and kill people. And that's kind of not really interrogated deeply. But then when we have this faker, Chaudhry, who is like, you know, I want to go and kill people, we're here appalled by, and as we should be as human beings, we should be appalled by anyone's desire to go somewhere and kill people. But there's no moment of reflection as to what are the differences between state-sanctioned violence and non-state violence. Like, we can't even raise that question, because we just need to make state violence good and benevolent and necessary. And that is all over this whole podcast. And she is kind of part of that arm of the do-goodingness of U.S. military intervention.
Yeah, and it's the new generation of people that we've been raised with, which is this embedded class, right? Like, before, the relationship wasn't as formalized, right? We were always told, like, oh, Vietnam War, they didn't police the media enough. They didn't censor the media enough. So, like, you saw a lot of violence. But, like, as we saw with the case of Iraq, you did not see that violence. Like, they cleansed that image. A million Iraqis died. But did we see the bodies? The one time we saw that was Abu Ghraib, and the worst of the Abu Ghraib images we never saw, right? Like, that's the reality. Like, they are the ones who cleanse the media, not us. Like, that's something that, like, I try to hammer home to my lib friends. And it's like, guys, you don't get it. Like, you don't see the corpses. You don't see the limbs. You don't see, like, the blown up bodies. Like that shit is not normalized here. Here, it's sanitized. It's a quick clip. It's done from far away. They show the telemetry and shit like that. But it's never the consequences of our violence, which is infinitely greater than what ISIS could ever do, by the way. Right. And that's what's never spoken to, as you just said. Right. Like they're I'm basically restating what you just said. So like that violence is never accounted for. And instead, what's substituted is this heavily orientalized, heavily racialized. Look on this brown on brown violence. Actually, you know, there's a dissertation to be written on Orientalism of ISIS versus the Orientalism of, say, Chicago gang violence, right? Because that same kind of Fox News brain of, oh, look, they're animals and they're doing animalistic things to each other, like that operates on both. Oh, I'm yelling a lot. Sorry.
No, I mean, it's so infuriating. It's both comic and infuriating. And it's also like what is really upsetting to me about this is all of the critical acclaim, right?
Like, yeah.
The this was made for a white gaze and it succeeded.
Good job, Frank. Good job, Calamari. Whatever. Great work. Let's have a big cigar. And it's like they never, does it ever dawn on these people that like you are mining violence and trauma of others for your profession? That's what you do with your life. And I feel that like this fiction, I can't believe she said that. And now I have to go listen to it.
He didn't.
This fiction of savior, of white savior. Of course, that's what she goes. Of course, she's obvious about it. Of course, like, whatever. Like, I don't know. It's just, oh, I can't even talk. I have no words. I have no words left.
I listened to it so other people
Thank you.
Wouldn't have to.
Thank you. You walked. You walked so we could run. Emberdy, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for all your support of the podcast. My God, I can't believe this took so long. Can we?
Thank you for all this
thank
work.
Thank you. No, my God.